Sleepy Little Raccoon Chatter podcast will contain adult content and language, as well as dark humor throughout many episodes. If you're continuing to join me in my chatter, welcome to the forest. Show's about to begin. Happy holidays, Sleepy Little Raccoon Chatter Podcast Critter Friends. I am excited. It's episode one finally here. I am apologetic. It is later than I expected. I was hoping to have a guest as well. And just life on life terms. It's just not working out that way right now. But I am getting this out here for you. I'm already in process of getting episode 2, The 12 Ghosts of Christmas, going, and I look forward to so much more with you guys. So I'm just going to dive right in. At approximately 11:30 p.m. on December 24th, 2008, Bruce Padro knocked on the door in Covina, California, dressed in a Santa suit and holding what appeared to be a wrapped gift. In the house were 25 people, including children, enjoying a Christmas gathering. One would think this is why Bruce was dressed as Santa and carrying the present. But sadly, that was not the case. Immediately upon opening the door, Bruce pulled out 2 9mm semi-auto handguns and shot his 8-year-old niece, Katrina, injuring her in the face. Padro then proceeded to fire randomly at fleeing guests. When he finished firing his guns, he unwrapped his present, which contained a homemade flamethrower, and sprayed the home with racing fuel, setting it on fire. During this chaos, however, one guest was able to flee and call 911. After the attack, Padro had driven to his brother's house, changed already into street clothes. Later, his brother would come home to find Bruce deceased from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Those who Padro had murdered in Covina had to be identified by dental and medical records due to the intensity of the fire. Police speculate that he may have stood over and pointedly executed some victims using 2 other 9mm guns that he had in the package with the flamethrower. Victims include 3 whose deaths were a direct result of gunshot wounds. This was Sylvia Ortega Pardo, 43-year-old ex-wife, Alicia Ortega, 70-year-old ex-mother-in-law, Joseph Ortega, 80-year-old ex-father-in-law. 4 have died from a combination of fire and gunshot wounds. 2 stem from fire alone. Other victims noted were Charles Ortega, 49-year-old former brother-in-law, Sherry Ortega, 45-year-old sister-in-law, James Ortega, 51-year-old brother-in-law, Teresa Ortega, 52-year-old sister-in-law, Alicia Ortiz, 46-year-old sister-in-law, and 17-year-old nephew Michael Ortiz. Not only were these lives tragically taken, 13 children were left as orphans, and 2 others were left with only one parent. So what would cause Bruce Padro to do this horrible act? Police and others feel that this is triggered by a layering of events. Bruce's divorce was finalized 1 week prior on December 18th. The Covina home where he appeared as Santa was his former in-laws. The divorce was believed to stem from a child that Padro had concealed from previous relationship. Part of the final divorce order also was that Bruce was to pay $1,785 in spousal support and a $10,000 settlement to his ex-wife. During this time period, Padro had lost his job and felt that the divorce outcome was unfair. The why of the gruesome act has been given, but why did he not shoot himself in the same home? Why did he travel about 30 miles away to his brother's home to commit his suicide? It's speculated as well that Bruce had planned to flee to Canada based on a plane ticket he had purchased. But due to third-degree burns he incurred during the flamethrower use, he changed his plans. Police found his rental car also was parked 1 block away from his brother's home, with remnants of a Santa suit being rigged up to detonate if the car was moved. I mean, I guess Santa really did go crazy that night. And it's tragic. You can look it up. There is more details. Again, these are just brief little snippets to kind of touch base on these crimes. I am not trying to take away from any intensity of what happened. So, with that said, I'm moving right along to number two, Alexis Valdez. 18-year-old Alexis Valdez was living with his aunt and her 41-year-old boyfriend, Sylvester Diaz Hernandez, for about 6 months. The agreement was Alexis would continue school, work, and pay bills. Over time, Valdez no longer did any of the agreed on, and December 24th, 2013, Alexis' aunt and Diaz asked Valdez to move out. The aunt then continued to go with her Christmas Eve plans and left for a party, while Diaz went out as well. During this time, Valdez was alone in the house drinking and getting angered over being asked to move out. Late in the evening, Diaz returned home and noticed that Valdez drank all the beer, so he tells Alexis that they are going together to the store to get more. Before leaving the house, Valdez placed a hammer near the door. Upon returning from the store, Valdez picked up the hammer and hit Diaz's head multiple times with it. Once Diaz was dead, Valdez covered the windows and played loud music as he dismembered Diaz. He went as far as gouging the eyeballs out with his own fingers and cutting off Diaz's ears, nose, and head with a knife and saw. Then, because still angered with his aunt, he placed the head, ears, and nose on his aunt's bed as a Christmas present. The process had exhausted Valdez, and he called 911 to report a dead body. The dispatcher reported that when asked if Alexis performed CPR, he laughed and replied that the victim had been decapitated. Little emotion of guilt was ever shown, even as police arrived at the scene where Valdez was on the porch covered in blood. They asked what happened, and Alexis only asked if they should arrest him before asking questions. He did note that if his aunt would have come home, he too would have killed her as well, and he pleaded guilty and was given 33 years. I don't know, 33 years with that much thought and intent behind it, and the fact that he was going to go after the aunt as well. I don't know, I feel like 33 years for that is just not that much. But, I mean, I'm not the judge, I'm not the jury, I'm just giving the details of what I found. The next one is a little lengthier. Number three, Ernest Holaver Jr. in Middleton, PA. Well, Middletown, sorry. Christmas tradition for the Holaver family was to have Christmas Eve dinner at Gene Holaver's parents, Joe and Mary Bittman's house in Johnstown, PA. They would then stay over, wake up to open presents on Christmas Day. On Christmas Eve of 2002, Gene Holaver, her two daughters, Elizabeth, Izzy, 15 years old, and Victoria, 20, as well as Victoria's 9-month-old grandbaby, Madison, were expected to still carry on this tradition. Normally, Ernest Holaver Jr. would be expected there as well. But this year, Gene and Ernest had separated that summer, and Ernest was not permitted at the home due to charges of sexual offenses against his daughters. When Gene and the girls failed to show up at Joe and Mary's home, Mary made attempts to call Gene's number. When no contact was able to be made with Gene, Mary was concerned and called the police to inquire if any accidents that may have delayed Gene were reported. She even called Middleton police to request a welfare check on her daughter's home. Mary was told to call back the next day if her family still had not shown. Christmas morning had arrived, and Gene and the girls were still not able to be contacted. At 7 a.m., Sergeant Robert Givler started his shift by being dispatched to do a welfare check on the Holaver home. At first, nothing suspicious was seen by the sergeant. His attempts to knock and ring on the doorbell at the front door had no success and no answer. Nothing was really able to be seen through the windows, so he proceeded to the back of the home. This is when he noticed the windows and the garage door were broken. He checked to see if the garage door was latched, and it lifted easily. He sees the family car still in the garage and proceeds to knock on the door leading into the home from the garage. It fell open, and he entered as announcing himself. When no reply was heard, In the door that leads to the hallway, he discovered a body of a female laying on the floor and cold to the touch. At this point, Sergeant Givler calls for backup. When backup soon arrives, they, with Sergeant Gilver, clear the bottom floor, and then they hear a noise coming from upstairs. When they climb the stairs with guns drawn, the body of a deceased female was seen with a baby sitting in the crook of her arm. See, these cases hit me when there's babies. Sergeant Gilver continues search of the house while his backup takes the baby downstairs and waits for an ambulance to ensure that Madison was not injured. As Gilver continued his search, he came across a third female body laying across the bed in a bedroom at the end of the hallway. All three victims had been shot with a small caliber weapon. Jean had been shot in the head. She was the first victim found in the kitchen. Police believe she was shot around 4 a.m. The second female found was Victoria. She was shot on the top of her head. Police are believing that this was because she crouched over to protect Madison. I mean, that's just mommy. It's just mommy instinct. Her location was right outside the bedroom door of where the third female was. Izzy was laying across her bed with a single gunshot wound to her left eye. Burn marks on her hand do suggest that she grabbed the barrel of the gun as it was fired. Oh, she was 15. It's just, and she tried, and it saddens me. During the investigation, police found several aspects of the scene to suggest it was someone who knew the family. And once they discovered the sexual charges, PFA, and separation from Ernest, they drove to Cambria, 3 hours away, to question him. Ernest's brother, Scott Holaver, brought Ernest to the local police station. Ernest and Scott gave these squat, like, wow, I'm not even trying to, like, shame anybody in this for a minute. Oh, speak, mouse, speak. English is my first language, I swear. Ernest and Scott gave the same alibi that they were out spotting deer and coyote from about 2 a.m. to 9:10 a.m. Like, I go spotting a lot, and that's not the hours I choose, but, you know, hey, each their own. After clearing some other possible suspects and getting search warrants that were obtained for the Holaver residence in Cambria County and for Scott's vehicle, police discovered that in Scott's trunk there was a notebook with a note in Scott's handwriting that says, "We were out spotting deer and coyotes." Okay, come on, people. If you're going to collaborate a alibi together, don't leave it in a notebook. Obvious that you're plotting together on it and making sure your stories collaborate. Like, come on. Ernest asserted his right to remain silent and waited for an attorney, while Scott kept to his alibi until pictures of the crime scene were shown to him. Scott then broke down and confessed. Scott's story was that he drove Ernest to Jean's home because while they were drinking, Ernest said he wanted to go get his dog. They arrived close to 4 a.m. Ernest had Scott parked down the block. Taking some items from the back seat, Ernest took off towards his estranged wife's home. He returned 10 minutes later in an agitated state, telling Scott to drive them back to Cambria County, but not to their home. He directed to go further north into the woods. Once there, Ernest left the car, taking a pistol and a shotgun, but he didn't return with them. Ernest would not end up explaining anything to Scott. January 2003, Ernest Holaver Jr. was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder. State sought death penalty. Scott was charged with an accomplice but pled to 3 counts of third-degree murder and was given 12 to 25-year sentence before being eligible for parole. While in jail, Ernest attempted to hire a hitman to kill Frankie Ramos, Madison's father, and make it look like a suicide with a confession note placed next to him. Ernest is still in jail with a death sentence, and all appeals have been exhausted, as noted, since January 2019. So the next few were a tad bit shorter, just either because there wasn't much details, or it was just they didn't need to go into details. Enough was said with what I found. And with that said, number 4, Elkin Clark. 49 years old, was working in Atlanta, Georgia Mall as a Santa in December of 2004. He wasn't giving out coal to those he thought he was not, that were naughty. Allegedly, 74-year-old Annie Nelson attempted to steal Hershey chocolate from Clark. This enraged him and led him to severely beating Nelson with a 2x4 board. Clark claims he asked Nelson not to touch his stuff several times. Though witness state that Clark struck Nelson over the head, then while she was lying unconscious on the floor, he struck her 2 more times. When Aisha Elbritton, a witness, tried to intervene, Clark threatened her with a board as well, and Nelson died 6 weeks after the incident. Clark was convicted of malice murder and simple assault of a Britton. Number 5. Some of these names are so hard to pronounce, and I'm going to do my best. I listened to several other places. I looked up how to pronounce them, and it's just, some of them are really hard, so I'm going to do my best in this case, because the names are not easy names to just go off face how they're spelled. So, Fatma Ramadi and her family carried on their normal Christmas morning until her estranged husband, Aziz Yazdempena, who was not invited, appeared in a Santa suit. A text was sent by his 22-year-old niece to a friend about him being there in the Santa suit, and it was annoying how he wanted to act all fatherly now. 20 minutes after that text was sent, Aziz called 911 and calmly said, "I am shooting people." In the background, there was heard sounds of people screaming for help. He had killed his estranged wife, their 2 teenage children, and 3 other relatives. It was said that this was due to the separation and financial strain, leading to Aziz being jealous of his estranged wife's success. After he killed the 6 victims and called 911, he then took his own life, but not before trying to place one of the guns in his brother-in-law's hands to frame him. Number 6. Charles Lawson. December 1929, shortly before Christmas, Charles Lawson, 43, took his family, Fanny, 37, Marie, his daughter, 17, Arthur, his son, 16, Carrie, the daughter, 12, Maybelle, whose daughter is his daughter, 7 years old, James, 4-year-old, and Raymond, 2-year-old, as well as Mary Lou, the 4-month-old daughter, to buy new clothes and get a family portrait done. The picture-perfect Christmas mood-setting day, right? Little did the family know, it was just part of Charles' premeditated violent plan. On December 25th, in the afternoon, Charles would end up killing all but 1 family member and himself. He sent Arthur to town for an errand. It still is not known why he sent Arthur to town, but Arthur was sent to town, and Charles waited by the tobacco barn for Carrie and Maybelle. Remember, they are only 12 and 7, as they began to set out for their uncle and aunt's house. As they came into range, he shot them with a 12-gauge shotgun. To ensure they were dead, he proceeded to bludgeon them before placing them in the barn. Charles returned to the house and shot Fanny as she sat on the porch. Inside, Marie heard the gunfire and screamed. James and Raymond attempted to find a hiding place. Lawson shot Marie, then found the 2 boys. His final kill was the baby, Mary Lou. Once he was done, he went into the woods for several hours before shooting himself. All the bodies of the family were found with their arms crossed and rocks under their heads. No one knows the exact reason for Charles committing such a heinous act, but one theory is relating to a head injury he sustained months prior. Another rumor was that Charles was sexually abusing Marie, and it was beginning to surface through the town. I mean, there are several other sites that give a few more details, such as, like, when the police arrived and found Charles, there was pace marks around the tree that he was found near. It's, God, again, I didn't want to go too much detail because, again, I don't do well with children involved. So I am going to take a brief break right there, guys. And we're at the halfway point. The next one, a couple do have a little more details. So I'm going to take a break. Please, please stick around to the end because number 12 has a twist. Welcome back. We are on number 7 of 12 Murders of Christmas. Right off the bat, I do want to say a couple details of this case conflicted between sources, and I just came to the conclusion that those particular details were not significant enough to the outcome of the incident. Therefore, it's not that I don't care about details of cases, but decided these particular ones would not affect anything and either would be left out or I just go with the one that I most found stated and credited. Connie Villa, 35 years old, and Adam Villa, 33, had recently divorced. Adam was trying to gain custody of their four children, ages 3, 5, 8, and 13. And on December 25th, 2013, in Casa Grande, Arizona, 911 was called by Adam, saying his wife had stabbed him during a domestic dispute and that he was on his way to the hospital. Police went to Connie's apartment. Having to force their way in, they found Connie bleeding from self-inflicted stab wounds. Further in the house, 13-year-old Anrielle Macy's was found deceased on the floor, and there was no apparent wounds visible. All children were taken to the hospital, where it was discovered that the three younger children had narcotics in their system. Autopsy and toxicology tests of the 13-year-old concluded she too had narcotics and was suffocated to death. Later, Connie had admitted she tried to kill all the children with narcotics, and when it didn't work, she choked Anrielle. It is said Connie did this as to ensure Adam would never gain custody. The younger children were released to Adam's family, and he was released from the hospital a few days later. Connie was given a life sentence for the first-degree murder of her 13-year-old daughter and 155.5 years for the attempted murder of Adam and the younger children.
Without going like so far in the depth of my personal life, I'm a mom. I've separated from all my kids' dads, and never once would I think, like, if I can't have the kids, nobody can, and I would go to that extreme. It just, I don't know, I think it hurts me more when it's a mom doing this, because I'm a mom. So, again, that's another reason why I just kind of kept that case short. The details were scattered. It was rough, but I felt it needed, you know, put into this 12 Murders of Christmas, because it's not often we do hear about the women snapping like that. But I'm going to move right along to number 8. Roger Cooper, 41 years old, a Costco's manager, was having a relationship with two employees, a long-term female and a 34-year-old. Sorry, mouth, speak the English. 34-year-old Samina Iman. Samina was aware of the long-term relationship that Roger was having and understood that this meant she had to take time with him when she could get it. Samina and Roger had this relationship for about 2 years, and Christmas 2014 brought excitement for Samina when it was planned that the couple would get to spend Christmas Day at the Birmingham's Malmaison Hotel, and 2015 would officially start their life together. The dream was coming true for her. Except for while Samina was planning a future with Roger, Roger and his brother David were making plans to end the life together for Samina and Roger. A plan was made for December 12th. Roger told Samina to meet him at the hotel where she was a regular guest at because he had a surprise for her. Well, surprise, there was no room booked, and David sat in a hire car waiting to abduct her. Their brothers would text using phrases from Star Wars, such as Death Star complete, stay on target, you're expected, Vader, as code. No definitive reason was given for why the plan failed that day, but a new plan was needed. 12 days later, on December 24th,
at 4 p.m., Samina left work shortly after Roger. They met up nearby, and Samina took her luggage from her car, joined Roger in his. They set route for Leicester, possible quick visit to David before they moved on to Birmingham. During that travel, Samina had contacted her sister to check on family and confirm that she would be at her parents' for Boxing Day. Around 5 p.m., arrival at David's house led to an almost immediate attack on Samina, and she was smothered with chloroform. At 6:25 p.m., Roger began his travel back to Coventry, and David was to dispose of the body. Once back with his long-term partner, Roger sent a text to himself from Samina as to create an alibi. That never works. They ping towers. Like, this is still 2000s. Like, they ping towers. You cannot sit there and send yourself a text as an alibi from the same room when, obviously, she wasn't there. David wrapped the body at this time in cling wrap and a sleeping bag, and within hours placed it in a grave. Over the next few days, both brothers took care of other details to cover up the crime, such as moving Samina's car, wiping down fingerprints. But obviously, when she's already talked to her family and said, yes, I'll be there for Boxing Day, and she didn't show, police were notified and a search began. Her car was located, and police found that the driver's seat was set back too far to have been driven by Samina. Okay, like, I'm 5'2", 5'3", depending on what shoes I'm wearing. And I know, like, the guys I've been with in the past are always taller than me. So when they drive my car, I have to get in and I have to scoot it forward. I have to readjust my mirrors. You know when the person driving it is the person driving it, and whether or not they were by the height of the seat. I mean, unless she, like, moved her seat way back to grab something that fell underneath, there's, like, that was an obvious red flag to the police, and it would have been to me, too. It didn't take them long to put pieces together. The phone showed that she was traveling with Roger last. On top of it, oh, Roger, you kept the bottle of wine that she bought for the trip and put it in your fridge. Like, so yeah, police found the bottle of wine and snacks that there was a receipt for from Samina. Like, also, a tip-off from the public led them to finding the outside edge of a sleeping bag. The brothers were arrested on suspicion of murder January 7th in 2014 and charged on the 9th. Both were found guilty and serving 30 years each by Christmas of 2014. Number 9. The Ashland tragedy. The Gibbon household was filled with joys of three teenagers. Robert Gibbons, 14, Franny Gibbons, 14, and Emma Carrico, 15. All three were awaiting Christmas morning together. Mrs. Gibbons was away for that night visiting her oldest daughter, and Mr. Gibbons was working in another town. Emma's mom, who was a nearby neighbor, had looked out the window earlier to check on the Gibbons home, and all seemed well. Later, the sound and sight of a fire would alert neighbors, including Emma's mom. At the crime scene, a crowbar and other murder weapons were found drenched in blood with hair. The attending physicians reported that victims had been bludgeoned to death and skulls were smashed to pieces. Evidence also showed that the two girls were brutally raped. The fire was an attempt to just cover the crime scene, which anybody that listens to true crime knows that never works. It always gets discovered. And as police investigated and questioned suspects, George Ellis made a confession, hoping for leniency. He claimed that the crime had been discussed for months with William Neal, implicating that he would have carnal communication with Emma before Christmas. Ellis also stated that a few evenings prior to the 24th, George Kraft stated he was going to see Fanny Gibbons and take her some black candy, have intercourse with her, and wanted George to come with him. It was about midnight when the three men proceeded to the Gibbons home. He went into further details of step-by-step of what happened, which, yeah, I'm not placing that in here because, again, this is just a short glimpse and I have kids. I can't do it. January 16th, 1882, they stood trial and sentenced to death. On May 30th, however, a mob pulled George Ellis from the cell and lynched him. William Neal and George Kraft, however, were hung on October 12th, 1883 and March 27th, 1885 by an executioner. Number 10. This one, I don't know. Like, it got to me. I heard it on several other areas. It was on a lot of lists for the 12 Burdens of Christmas, so I put it in there. It got to me because it just saddens me that there's such a bright future and it went downhill quick. William Brandon Adelot was 17. He was a star pitcher for the Gulf Breeze High School. He had a hard 80-mile-per-hour fastball and was scouted by many colleges, which I can barely throw a rock to cause damage. So, I mean, this kid definitely had a future. His mother, Sharon Hill Adelot, was a science teacher at the Holy Navra Middle School, teaching 7th and 8th graders for about 15 years. Brandon was said to have been staying with a friend on and off since about September of 2013 due to a rough relationship between his mom and him, and no one would have ever expected what happened on December 24th of 2013. Christmas Day, Sharon was found in a pool of blood and a knife in her eye. Brandon was found 3 hours later at a friend's house in clean clothes but dried blood on his wrist, and confessed to the murder when he was arrested with a smile on his face. He had beat her with a baseball bat, slit her throat, and stabbed her in the eye. He reportedly said to have done it because he was angered by his mother and family making him go to rehab after falsely accusing him of using drugs. He said he felt he did the right thing when he was asked about how he felt about killing his mom. Brandon was found not guilty by reason of insanity with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and during the time of the murders, he was experiencing auditory delusions telling him to kill his mom. The sentence was that he was ordered to involuntary commitment at a state mental hospital with every 6-month reevaluation. In 2019, he was moved to a less restrictive facility. I was also reading while doing this research, and I didn't add any details really on it because, like, I'm not sure how far they go, but Brandon's aunt has been in contact with him through letters, and I guess another push for him being moved was because, like, for a while, his roommate was another man who killed his mom on Mother's Day, and Brandon's aunt didn't feel that it was the best for her nephew to be in a cell with another mommy killer when Brandon was a very impressionable man or child at the time. I mean, he was 17, so he is a child. As far as being moved to the less restrictive facility in 2019, that was the most recent update I was able to find. I do want to state that if any point in time during these 6-month reevaluations he gets cleared, he could be out walking again. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I would love to believe that a 17-year-old that had this moment of mental health crisis could rehabilitate and be out in public with no problems in the future. So with that, I'm going to move on to a very short one. Number 11, the Los Feliz Mansion. Dr. Harold Perelson, Lillian, his wife, Judy, 18-year-old daughter, and their two younger children lived together in a beautiful 1920s mansion. December 6, 1959, Dr. Perelson succumbed to financial strain and at 4:30 a.m. brutally murdered
I am like Adam Sandler's Moira, brutally murdered Lillian with a ball peen hammer while she slept in their bed. He then went down the hall to Judy's room and struck her with a hammer. Luckily, she had woke and was able to dodge the next attempted blow. She got to escape to a neighbor's house and contact police. But her screams did wake her two younger siblings. Harold was unable to attack the two younger children and told them to go back to bed, that this was just a nightmare. He proceeded back to where Lillian lay dead, took a fistful of pills, and died before 9/11 arrived. And last reported, the house remained unoccupied. All right, guys, we are at number 12. And again, I told you there is a twist if you wait until the end. This is not a murder, but I did want to end this segment on a slightly lighter note. Not saying that any crime committed should be taken lightly, or that the victim doesn't deserve to be respected, as if he's any other victim in any cases I would discuss. Just the case in general is not as gruesome as the murders I gave up above. And when you hear the weapon choice, it might be the dark sense of humor in me, possibly the family joke in us. I laughed. I didn't laugh at the victim. I laughed at the overall scenario. So with that, on Christmas of 2013, police had arrived to the home of 44-year-old Helen Williams, where a man was covered in blood. Williams had told police that the man fell and cut himself, but yet she couldn't explain why there was blood on her hands and clothes. Upon questioning the male, he told police that Williams was angered that he had returned without beer. I mean, the stores were closed. It's Christmas. What'd she expect? But she grabbed a ceramic squirrel, beat him in the head, and then stabbed him in the shoulder and chest. I mean, again, it is Christmas. There is not going to be anywhere open. You can't just go run to the store. You knew Christmas was coming. It comes the same time every year. Go stock up on your stuff beforehand. Don't take it out on him that people wanted to go celebrate with Santa and their kids and family. And, I mean, grabbing the ceramic squirrel, that takes a whole new definition to, like, hey, I was going to grab this, but squirrel. Williams was charged with domestic violence. Guys, I'm going to end this with, I know this, I know holidays make people stressed when it's a time that's supposed to be joyous. I know mental health is a big thing triggered more during the holiday season. Just know you're not alone. You don't have to go to extremes. It's 2020. We've all been stressed. We're hoping 2021 brings on something better. Don't hesitate to call or reach out to somebody before you feel like you're at your snap. I mean, hey, email me, sleepylittleraccoonchatterpod@gmail.com. Hit the Anchor link and go straight to my Anchor and send me a message. Reach out. I'm even on TikTok as Sleepy Little Raccoon. You need, just follow me, message me. Hey, I do have a Facebook page starting, the Sleepy Little Raccoon Chatter Podcast. Post in there, hey, I'm struggling, I need help. Like, we're all feeling it from 2020. Obviously, it goes back further than that for these holidays. Guys, you're never alone. It's okay not to be okay, but know that there's help. With that being said, guys, I do thank you for sticking it out through this. I know it wasn't as an exciting and, like, blown out, detailed first episode. I know the quality isn't that great right now, but I appreciate you sticking with me. And I do have episode 12 or episode 2 coming up, the 12 Ghosts of Christmas. which I'm going to hopefully make sure that's better. The more you continue to go with me, the more you support me, the more I see you guys wanting me to keep going, the more I'm going to continue to make better quality, the more I'm going to continue to push to strive to be better for you. Again, as I stated previously, I do want to work on doing like critter friend stories. If you have suggestions or your own personal paranormal, true crime, or topic suggestions, you can write them in to sleepylittleraccoonchatterpod@gmail.com. If you click the Anchor link in the description box, it'll also take you to my Anchor site so that you can chat with me there. Guys, I look forward to episode 2 and just continuing this journey with you. I hope you all have a wonderful night. And remember, there's always something to smile about. And there's always room for you in the forest. See you next time.